The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt, and again today, as always, I will be taking us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those rich with the essence of constant renewable. It is great to be back, as I have so much pleasure about engaging in this show and the material involved, but I must say this week, the pleasure is combined with the delight of an absolutely awesome physical view here. I am at about 10,000 feet in the Intermountain West of the United States. I'm looking at the Colorado Rockies and the Rocky Mountain National Park as we speak. Snow-capped peaks, bright sunshine, clear as a bell, and all of this from the conference center here as the broadcast point today for the continuing dialogue that we're having on what is really going on in the world and how might we shape clear views of possibility for living into the future. And I must say, actually, the real pleasure today is the topic that we have at hand and my guest, who I'll introduce shortly. And the topic is one I was introduced to by my guest, James Quilligan, about 3 years ago. And it's been, I think, an important one for me to simmer with and the conversation we have. The topic is the commons, as we'll call it, and economic transformation. And I think for many of you, it's not a household word yet, nor a household view, but one that was recently acknowledged with the award of the Nobel Prize in Economics to Eleanor Ostrom for her groundbreaking work in this realm. James Quilligan joined us earlier in the year for our first step, look and introduction to the commons, and we really want to continue and deepen that today. And moreover, I think, to clarify the concept, the potential, and the form that work in the commons might really take. And also today, I hope that we can bring more clarity through the discussion because at least in some of the media, particularly in where I live in the southeastern U.S., it seemed that media didn't really get the nature of Eleanor's work, the concept behind it, and really didn't adequately describe what is really meant by the notion of the commons. And I hope we can do that, do more with that today to bring clarity to it. And for those listeners that might also tune into many other talk shows, and even some conservative talk shows to boot, even Rush or Glenn Beck, know at the outset, the commons by word does not point us toward socialism or Marxism. And I think as you'll begin to see more clearly in our investigation here, it has more to do really with regaining sovereignty in civil society over realms of life and living systems that are ignored, discounted, or grossly mismanaged by our current public and private sectors, the coziness yet polarization that occurs there, and the market state interplay and the economic system that comes with it. Those are the areas that the commons, I think, is pointing to and that James will be exploring with us more today. For new listeners, though, let me just introduce James. He is a policy advisor and analyst and writer for many international leaders and politicians, including Pierre Trudeau, François Mitterrand, Edward Heath, Willy Brandt, Jimmy Carter, His Royal Highness Prince Al-Hassan, just to name a few. He served as economic consultant to 26 countries, including the U.S., and he's been an advisor both to the U.N. and to the development agencies there. His writings and publications have appeared in many international realms. He's been in The Economist, International Herald Tribune, Washington Post, Newsweek, just to name a few. And James is working on at least two other books that I'm aware of and has an article forthcoming in the next issue of Cosmos Journal entitled People Sharing Resources Toward a New Multilateralism of the Commons. James, just a great pleasure to have you back on the show with us today. Thanks for coming and continuing this conversation on the Commons.
Hi, John. Delighted to be here, and thank you for that marvelous introduction. The clarity in Colorado is really with you, and I hope I can extend that into our conversation.
Well, likewise, the clarity I think that I gained, James, when I talked to you on this subject is one that's helpful to me. As I mentioned as we were coming in, I'm still a neophyte, I think, in this realm. So I think many listeners will gain from that because I'll be continuing to ask questions just like a neophyte here. But it is significant to me, James, and maybe you can comment to begin this, that Eleanor's work and putting even the language of the commons at the forefront of the world seems to be a very productive step forward.
I think so, too. And I think also that to begin this conversation, the symbolism of her being the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, I think is really terrific because the commons does represent a qualitative kind of economics vis-a-vis the quantitative, male-oriented economics of the past. And so I think it's really marvelous that she has become the first woman to win the prize because it does point the way to a much more user-friendly, qualitative sort of economics as we look forward, deeper into the possibility of social organization in the 21st century.
And James, I think that on Zoom here we've been having an awful lot of conversation, certainly from the personal standpoint, about connecting to more of the larger and the whole view. And that, to me, is what I feel like Eleanor's been doing. She's bringing a perspective to the table that's both a whole view and filling in parts of the view that's been missing. And maybe that's a good way for even new listeners to get a sense of this. Maybe start, James, with a sense of maybe a definition or a view of the commons and some of what it reflects that's not really addressed in the system as we know it, the public and private sectors I was talking about, and maybe even the fatal flaws, so to speak, that are behind some of this unsustainability that we've been talking about on Zoomed over some months now.
Yeah, the basic way of understanding the commons, the very beginning way of orienting oneself to this, is just to recognize that there are certain problems that the private sector isn't able to manage, and there are also problems that the public sector is not able to manage. And therefore, if civil society locks themselves into a position where we think, well, it's got to be either private or public, and which one are we going to go with? Which one are we going to get our funding from? Which one are we going to rely on to make these changes take place? Then we may be deluding ourselves to think that that is the solution. It's painted kind of a false dichotomy for ourselves to think it's one or the other. And when I say public sector, I really mean the government sector rather than public thinking of the people themselves, because public, in effect, in modern political science has really come to mean the state sector. So in other words, if it's not the private sector or the state sector who are going to be able to manage problems like atmospheric pollution and space debris and pollution of the oceans and seabed mining and the melting of the icebergs and the global commons issues, and if they're not able to handle effectively the local commons issues, because we know resources are rapidly being depleted and disputes over management of resources in many places are leading to major conflicts and in themselves herald the prospect of wars over resources in the future. If it's not the public and state sectors who are going to be able to manage these things, then who is it and what is it? How are we going to be able to organize resources for the future? And there's a rich tradition in indigenous cultures, of course, and also a rich tradition in our own pre-modern Western societies of the commons. And the commons became rather famous during the era in Great Britain when commoners began to assert their rights to their local resources against the state and against the emerging private sector that really tried to exploit those resources. So that in itself frames the distinction. It's not private sector, it's not state sector, it's something different. It belongs to people, and the emerging term for it is the commons. And the commons doesn't necessarily just refer to the resources themselves. It refers to the relationships among people, the intersubjective realm between people who are managing the resources. So it has an objective and also a subjective aspect to it.
And that's great, James. And I think you just described to me and people that are regular listeners know that in Atlanta, they talk about resources. We've had water issues and resources, which has become actually a water war, a tri-state water war associated with our water, not only in Atlanta, but in the adjoining three states there. So I think that's a good representation. And likewise, as we're beginning to move, and I'm physically going to spend part of the year, most of the year down in Sarasota, Florida, there are resources down there that are the tangible resources, the physical resources like managing the bay, but it's also things like the arts and the social context around the arts and the culture and other dimensions. So it's both the physical and more of the social and the relational that you're really describing, isn't it, James?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, the commons are really areas of shared space or mutual interest that the private and public sectors usually don't include on their balance sheets because the values are too hard to monetize or because the private sector and the state choose not to declare their actual worth. But they involve different kinds of relationships that really provide meaning to communities and a source of wealth for communities. And they can be local, they can be state-oriented, they can be interstate, regional, as the example that you pointed out, or they can be global in scope. And they include a wide range of different kinds of resources. And this is the task for us now, is to be able to define the relationships between these resources and understand that they all have something in common.
Yes, and I think in our first show you're really describing, and you point into it here well, that many of these resources, because they can't be monetized, or because there's not the interest of the private sector to monetize it, that it doesn't have value, and so the externalities, which really aren't even included, or it can't be managed effectively cross boundaries by public. So then we find ourselves as the people, so to speak, living and engaging and wanting to preserve the commons in Atlanta, the water, in Atlanta, the air, Atlanta, certain aspects of the cultural history and lifestyle. But it's difficult because it can't really be accomplished well by public and private, and that's what we've been facing in a place like Atlanta, where sustainability, although it's a watchword, has really been challenging to get moving on that. So that feels, James, like it's at least a starting point in terms of definition, and I got to imagine that where we continue, it's going to be useful to try to frame this more about the elements and what makes up the commons and how not only if we start to tag them, it's how do we consider them. Maybe as I hear the music in my ears, which is suggesting that after our opening here in some definition, James, that we need to take a short break. So let me do that, invite listeners back to continue this conversation as we go on, and let James even describe more about the basic elements and what characterizes the commons, the nature of co-governance, co-production, really about how to manage it and how to really create and to build the value in it. We're Zoomed on this Monday, exquisite, crisp day here in the Rockies, as well as it is back east where James is. Join us in a moment again. Thanks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Ugh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, here we are back on Zoomed. As I have been suggesting in previous weeks, we're staying out at the big picture for several weeks here, trying to begin to frame even more clearly connecting the dots in a number of ways. James Quilligan, my guest today, economist, policy advisor, leader to many, many, many of these conversations around the world. We're delighted to do that and continue it. Our conversation is the commons. So, James, I was just leading with some examples, but there are some varieties or different varieties of commons, and perhaps you can give some examples, maybe connect the dots, as I was even suggesting, and let's bridge forward with the commons perspective.
Right. Well, you know, when people hear the word commons, they think of natural resources, and certainly it does involve fisheries and agriculture and forests and land, pastures, ecosystems, gardens, seeds, food crops, genetic life forms, living creatures. It certainly includes all of those elements, but it also includes things like indigenous culture and traditions and community support systems and our social connectedness and women's and children's rights and family life and health and education and religion and ethnicity and many things like that, and other aspects, too, involving the intellectual framework, like human knowledge and wisdom and scientific knowledge and intellectual property, information, communication flows, and also things that we think of as more technological, like our airwaves and the Internet, and then, of course, the arts and culture. And also our purchasing power. Money is a kind of commons, and the social right to issue money is a commons. So all of these things have a common thread, meaning that they're ultimately not in the province of the state sector or the private sector, and that's really what ties all these things together, and that provides the opportunity for people to see these resources in a whole new way.
And so in some respects, it's sort of disparate. And in some respects, just defining the commons is maybe, as you were saying, not exact. It's maybe a little hard to recognize. But these are all things we're very familiar with, James. And although I might not, in my own language, describe this as a third sector, it feels to me what you're describing is capturing the importance and the value and the acknowledgement of these important elements, the life-sustaining elements, some of the central dimensions of our life, which aren't explicitly in these other sectors. It's explicitly providing a context for how we might manage and engage and sustain those. And is that one way to think about it?
That's exactly it. It's not really a third sector until we define it as such and we organize around it. And so at the moment, the conversation around the commons generated by Eleanor Ostrom and many others is really about identifying and creating awareness around these common issues and to recognize the potential of a third sector that can organize around them. And then that leads into the topic, of course, of the management of these resources or the co-governance of the resources.
Right. So that begins to get a sense of how to explicitly provide some recognition. And, I mean, I guess that's kind of a movement toward it. But it does have to do with some defined sense of a more explicit means of managing it and recognizing value. And could you say a little bit more about that, James? Because I know that the two pieces in your article really pointed to co-governance and co-production as two really central dimensions or characteristics that this exploration might take.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There are two aspects to the commons as far as human relationships go. And one is the management of the commons, and the other is the means by which the commons actually creates a new source of value. And to take the management first, we know that resources have to be managed. When people come together and fail to manage their resources effectively, that's often called a tragedy of the commons. And Eleanor Ostrom and others have been the ones who have pointed out, actually, that history shows that a tragedy of the commons isn't inevitable, that when people come together and manage their resources, they can actually have great success in being able to develop the resources and provide them from becoming vulnerable to encroachment and misuse that we know leads to a lot of social and ecological problems. So failed commons are not inevitable because when people come together and communicate and build trust and organize to create rules to govern how their resources should be managed, they can really protect these resources from overuse in the interest of the common good.
And so an example of that might be, I mean, the tragedy of the commons might be something as simple as all kinds of users around something like in Atlanta, the water, many, many users, or if we went back even in history way before the current times in Atlanta when there were a lot of cattle, for example, in addition to the growing, it would be about the way people would come together and the way the tragedy of the commons would be the extent to which we would be overgrazing or overdrawing water out with the absence of this collaboration and connection and local management. Is that sort of where it's heading?
Exactly. It's the overuse of resources because we're striving for too much of a good thing. And when certain resources are used by a smaller number of people, it's obviously very different from when they're used by a large number of people. And when those resources are depletable resources, then it can create problems over the sharing and management of the resources. And then people, get angry and it can create conflicts over the sharing of the resources. So the idea then is that in the past, we know that there are countless cultures, and our own culture, too, have particular rules for the management of the resources. It's just that at the moment, however, those rules are not benefiting the people who live near the resources and who may have formerly managed them, and also the people who are living at the grassroots who depend on those resources for their own livelihood and well-being.
So the example here, public and private sector, aren't being able to effectively manage the water and the draw of the water. We have the Corps of Engineers involved with their rules, as an example, about how much would be drawn, the time of year would be drawn, and so forth. But the reality of it, the system hasn't been working. People in Florida have been losing some crops and harvests in the bays in Florida and the scallops and so forth because we don't have the right mix of water, the volume of water, the quality of water. So it becomes a sense of how to manage this, but manage it more locally outside the public and the private sector, which aren't effectively being able to get the job done.
Exactly right. Yes, that's the key. And, of course, the states previously had been able to manage this in the tri-state area, for example, around Atlanta. But at the moment, however, that system is breaking down, which has, for me, two significant aspects. One is that people are beginning to recognize that they need to begin to manage the resources themselves in a way that the state has been unable to. But the other thing it really brings up is that people are recognizing the value of water now in a brand new way. And this is the important aspect of co-production, because it's the new kind of recognition that's emerging that there's another source of value that is emerging beyond the public and private sectors, which does create a new source of value. And obviously, with the increased privatization of water across the world, that issue is becoming very prominent. And we are recognizing that this new source of value really needs to be explored, because it's a source of value that is not part of the monetary system. And this is a very difficult thing for us to really understand, because what we think of as value right now is commercial value. It's monetary value. And there is actually another kind of value that we know from our own appreciation of the commons themselves. When we're appreciating nature, when we're appreciating our families, our social structures, it's a different sort of value that emerges from inside. But on a collective basis, that value is also shared. But we don't have an adequate language around that source of cultural value yet, where we can really organize around it. But that's part of the meaning of the commons, is to provide that new sense of cultural value.
And that value is one in which is beginning to build almost a timeless sense. It's building the sustainable side of this, so we're not going into the capital and drawing capital. We're living on the interest, so to speak, of those environmental realms and sustaining the value for future generations as well. It's an explicit attempt and movement to do that. And James, where I hear the music in my ears once again, so let's take our short break here. Let's do the messaging we need to and continue with our own messaging here about the commons and where this goes and how this can be activated into tangible forms. Come back here in a moment. We're here on Zoomed again on this Monday. James Quilligan is my guest. Our conversation is the commons, and it is a further view and look beyond the current system of not just looking at reform within the system. We're looking at the thought about restructure and redesign. Come back and join James and I here in just a moment.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888.
1-888-4680. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Sure, what's up?
There's this girl I kind of like.
Well, if there's one thing I know, it's women.
Really?
Well, they didn't call me Velvet for nothing.
I don't get it.
Smooth. I was smooth.
Oh.
Anyway, it's easy. You just got to impress her. Show her how strong you are.
Okay, but how?
Just, I don't know, pick up a lot of heavy things around her.
Like what?
I don't know, desks, chairs, people. Grunt, if you have to.
Grunt?
Yeah, be like, ugh! Try it.
Ugh!
See, there you go. And you should dress up. Start wearing a shirt and tie.
I'll look like a dork.
No, you'll look successful.
Okay.
And finally, you can start using my cologne. The ladies love it, so don't be shy. Splash it on.
Thanks, Dad.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt U.S. Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, marvelous conversation going on here with James Quilligan today. Our subject, the commons, giving a picture of it in terms of the definition, in terms of the characterization of it, as we have done, regarding co-governance and co-production. But move it, James, let's move forward. We've got some elements that move us more explicitly into the form that this might take, and that would head us into the legal framework and so forth. But a step to get us there seems to me, as we were just discussing, that there's something here about the rights of the commons that we need to explore first. Can you give us maybe a lead-in on that that gets us toward thinking about more of the legal frameworks that could be forms that would be generated?
Yeah, John, that's exactly the right point to make, I think. The framework that we live in now, in Western culture, is one of human rights, civil rights, and the fact is that commons rights are different than civil rights or human rights. And human rights, civil rights, depend on government to legitimate them. And the fact is, though, that as global citizens, regardless of our national obligations, we all have a responsibility to engage in areas of community or trans-border action where the state and the private sectors have little jurisdiction or authority or experience. So commons rights differ from human rights and civil rights because they arise not through the legislation of a state, but through a customary or emerging identification with a natural resource, a cultural resource area, a social need, or a form of collective labor. So commons rights actually affirm the sovereignty of human beings over the sustenance that they derive from their resources. And this is a big distinction then from civil rights and human rights. And it creates a whole new context for collective action.
Well, so you've just really come to the point I was making in the opening here that although it's not formed into a sector yet, what we're really pointing to with the commons rights is a sovereignty of human beings on this and an explicit recognition of that. And that seems to be a very important concept, especially in our conversation about the nature of sovereignty in some ways that the private sector tries to point to with freedom and the public sector tries to talk about in terms of equality. This seems like a very important notion that is underpinning this.
That's exactly it. Instead of seeking individual and human rights from the state, people actually have the power to claim long-term authority over resources and governance and social value as their planetary birthrights both at a community level and at a global level. And that means that commons rights provide an, a really important basis for creating new covenants in institutions that aren't state-managed to begin to negotiate the protection and sustenance of resources and ensure that the mutual interests of all the stakeholders in an area are represented.
Well, so that's then a good bridge, James, that we're acknowledging the commons rights. And out of that, then, as you're describing, and out of that sense of rights and that planetary birthright, that right that we all have to air and water and the legitimacy of the life-sustaining, thriving elements of what life is about on Earth, that there are forms out of that that could be manifested that brings more distinction to the commons. And what would those be? How would that actually, how do you move towards some legal framework to make that happen?
Well, I think we need to embark on the concept of social charters, and that would provide an, a social and institutional framework that gives incentives for management and protection of commons resources. Creating a social charter involves the support and involvement of people across a region or community of interest that depend upon a specific common resource for their livelihood. And they can be developed for single commons or for overlapping commons. You'd mentioned the case of Sarasota, and perhaps in Sarasota there's several different elements involved. There's the commons at the beach area, there's an artistic commons, and those seem to be commons within a different realms, but they actually have interests that are in common. So a social charter that would involve the arts and also natural resources is something that's really viable. It's very practical, and it can actually take place. But the thing to realize, though, is that by people asserting their inherent rights to a commons, the role of the state then becomes a lot more balanced between enabling the corporate sector and enabling citizens. So instead of regulating commerce and finance in the public interest, the new duty of the state would be to confirm the declarations of the rights of people to their commons, allowing them to manage their resources by recognizing and upholding their social charters. And that would be the key to creating a new legal infrastructure to further this. So that every social charter is a declaration that can be made into a legal document that has a binding legal aspect to it.
So let's take the example. I will be moving to Sarasota. I'll be living in Sarasota. I'm going to continue with some infrastructure of the Avastone business, certainly in Atlanta, but I'll be living down there, engaging with the community, with the community leaders across all the dimensions of the community. So let's take that. How would that form actually be generated in this case? In Sarasota, as an example, you have the resource base, a wonderful base of beaches, a wonderful base of waters on the Gulf. It's a source of tourism from the private sector. We have the arts being fundamental and a real draw in what's being done. There's other elements of health and vibrancy and dealing with the aging and so forth as a center, so to speak. And there are other dimensions of the economic logic that are there within Sarasota. So, James, what would actually happen? It's a group of private citizens, sovereignty of the civil society, so forth. How would that actually occur? How might that actually look? And how might that declaration really emerge, and how would it be presented to the world?
Well, the people in an area who are managing a resource, who are worried about the exploitation or overuse of a resource, come together, and these stakeholders begin to talk about creating a document based on the importance of those resources. And this social charter would include things like a summary of their claims to legitimacy as needing to use the resource, a declaration of their rights as users and producers of the resource, a code of ethics. It can involve the description of their common values and standards in using the resources and their need for them, a statement of the benefits accruing from the resources, and a statement of the re-territorialization that's necessary of certain boundaries that circumscribe the resources. And it can involve also a practical framework for cooperation. So when these stakeholders, and it can be citizens, social networks, academics, it could be scientists, bilateral donors, development partners, regional organizers, it could be the media, it could be any kind of stakeholder, actually, who has a vital interest in these resources. When they come together and create a social charter, they're actually ensuring that the administrative power of government is decentralized so that the people in the area can maintain access, community access, to their own commons, and also sovereignty over that commons.
Wow, so I'm hearing an action sense of pulling together. You were describing that earlier about the collaborative sense, this almost this sense of movement together on a particular focus and a topic and being able to bring this together in this social declaration. Sounds like that's a similar thing, for example, in the Southeast region that somehow could be done, or in Atlanta or in local area relative to water, or in Atlanta even relative to air. There could be something coming out of that where there's an explicit acknowledgement, those parties you're talking about, the stakeholders involved are coming forward, and it feels as if there's a sense of empowerment in a different way, and the sense of power here that's being brought to bear and an expression of that for the commons and for common rights. Is that an accurate way to say it, or am I kind of off on that one?
No, that's exactly it. There's a whole new realization among communities that they need to claim or develop some new framework for their own rights in managing the resources that they really depend on. And, you know, it involves water, it involves food, energy, the air. There are many things involved, but it goes beyond natural resources, because people are developing communities of interest on the Internet and through the arts and through many other modalities today. And those are all very legitimate commons that need to be protected from exploitation by the private sector and also regulation by the state.
So this actually seems to me to be a way that this becomes very personal, James, that in a time when people are voting and trying to make a statement relative to the government and the state and then hoping that that happens relative to the private sector, this is a very personal aspect of involvement, and this can really happen at a community level and start at a local community level, and it could grow from there. But this feels like a very personal way for people to engage, get involved, to exercise their own sovereignty, their own sense of what needs to be valued for themselves, for their children, for generations. It feels to me like it's another vehicle to really enable that. So, James, I can hear the music in my ears once again. More to come on this. We still need to talk about how this then, if there's a legal framework and a social declaration of this, how might this actually put into play in terms of the organizational structures? How do you actually make this operational? And that's what we want to do when we come back here on the final segment on Zoomed on this Monday in October. James Quilligan, our guest, come back in a couple of minutes for the last segment. This is just getting it started, but I think we've got more to talk about here. Come back in a moment.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind.
How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The Marsh Engel Show. Join the movement to empower yourself with the essentials of feminine power and success, and learn how women around the world are becoming more inspired, more influential, and absolutely amazing. Each week, Marsh sits down for an engaging conversation with women who are boldly committed to living their most amazing life. You'll discover ways to step into your greatest vision, deepen your relationships, and unleash your real creative brilliance. Get ready. It's time to jump into the conversation. That's Monday afternoons at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern for the Marsh Engel Show on the Voice America Business Network.
Do you need directions to solid financial future? If so, the Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with a roadmap to making smart money decisions in every area of your personal finances. Join Jordan every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 3 p.m. Eastern for the Money Answers Show on the Voice America Business Channel. Learn how and where to get the best deals on mortgages, cars, and insurance. Find out the best ways to save for college and retirement. Get out of debt, improve your credit rating, and save on your taxes. The Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with great tips on investment opportunities in real estate, stocks, annuities, and other investment vehicles. That's the Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman on the Voice America Business Channel every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back with James Quilligan again, conversation on the commons. And as I've been talking about in recent weeks, in particular here on Zoomed, our desire is not to come in with doom. We're coming in with reality of a recognition of flaws in our system, some of the fundamental flaws, and trying to paint a picture for the future, the potentiality to provide some visions of what can be the basis on which we can move forward productively and positively. That's what we're doing with James today, definition through to an understanding of the commons, and we've been talking about the social charter as a declaration of our commons rights. James, let's take that a step further and how we might make this operational. And I think one dimension that you've written in the upcoming article is about commons trusts as a structure and an operational form for that. Maybe you can introduce us to that and in our audience a little bit more today.
Yeah, that's it. The commons trusts really do operationalize the social charters. So this provides specific legal conditions for people to help each other manage and produce what each of them needs in a local resource area. And, you know, we've in the past recognized land trusts and forest trusts. They're fairly familiar examples, but commons trusts are now being developed in other realms as well, on the internet and many other places. These trusts usually involve physical and financial assets to preserve and manage the resources that are inherited from past generations on behalf of present and future generations. So this is really the key about commons trusts. They're the only fiduciary institutions that are accountable for long-term preservation and sustenance of a resource. And that's the key distinction to make. That's why the trusts are so important, because there are no institutions today that are really doing that.
And this, then, I've got to get a sense that this is beginning to establish a structure and a framework for an orientation to a very sustainable, renewable form of living. In other words, at some point, there's an underpinning of this about a form that acknowledges the nature of the resources, the current conditions of the resources, and ultimately, although we won't go there very explicitly, I think, today, James, because we don't have time, ultimately, this links directly into the economic system and that possibility, does it not?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The way that the private and public sectors are geared today is that they're really spending both the principal and the interest of the commons. And what has to happen now is we really need to preserve, we need to scale back that spending of the interest, and we really need to preserve the principal of the commons. And as we all know, because of the degradation of resources and the problems of climate change, and many of those kinds of resources are fast being eroded.
And so then these trusts are a means of local trusts, and I've got to imagine that there's a way that this becomes more broad, but there's a structure and ultimately an integration between a framework of actual governing of the local resources toward the sustaining of the principle for future generations. And explicitly, there's some way then to account in the economic system via the costs and the valuing of the resources, that there's some way to do this. We make explicit where the system doesn't get it now. We make it more explicit about how things are priced and valued in the marketplace. Is that a link where this begins to go?
Yes, it is. The commons trusts really have two functions. First, they have a responsibility to decide how much of their common resources should be monetized by renting them to the private sector for extraction and production. And the commons trust, in doing that, they guarantee that those who are unprotected have rights to basic sustenance from their own resources. But the commons trusts have a second responsibility, and that's to keep value created through the commons within the commons to the extent that's possible, so that the community can hold in reserve the larger portion of its natural genetic material stock for the benefit of people and resources and species that are still unborn. So this basically is a way of rebalancing the harmful effects of the private sector and the public sector as they exist today. Private industry would continue to flourish from the surplus resources that are rented to it from the commons trust. The socially marginalized and vulnerable people would receive a subsistence income from the state, and the primary assets of the commons would be preserved and managed. And that would create this new dynamic equilibrium that I think many of us are anticipating today.
And so it's a dynamic equilibrium with multiple elements to it, one of which is that ultimately we won't be externalizing the costs of the commons as we are now in the monetary system and not explicitly recognizing and including those. So just one dimension of that. And so we've only got about 3 minutes here left, James, but it seems to me that this is a work in process in terms of our conversation. I've got to imagine our listeners would have many questions and how these forms would actually develop, the nature of the trusts and so forth. But is this the leading edge of the work that's really going on in the commons?
Yes, it is. And it's going on at the local levels and also at the international level. And there's a lot of thought going into this, because we've really come to a dead end with the present economic and political system that we have now. So a lot of creative thought is going into how we really create a new future for ourselves that's dynamic and sustainable and equitable.
And so a community like Sarasota, or the sustainability leaders in a city, a vibrant city like Atlanta, really could be at the leading edge of this, of bringing forth and supporting some innovation in the where we go in the future, that this is not just about tinkering, as I was saying earlier, about the old system. This is really actually developing a new system. This is restructuring and redesigning the fundamental form in which we're living.
Yeah, it represents the possibility of creating this new dynamic equilibrium between private property rights, public sovereign rights, and common sustainability rights. And this is why it's such an exciting topic, I think.
Well, it feels to me like it's an exciting topic because so much of this polarity and so much of the political dialogue gets involved in this public-private sort of a polarity in the sides, and just where that gets bogged down seems to me like it's a wonderful opportunity to broaden that as we go forward. Let me connect our listeners here, though, to James, to his upcoming article. Again, it is in Cosmos Journal. I think if, as I've mentioned to many of you before, Cosmos Journal is a wonderful recognition, bringing forth perspectives on the future, the new systems, the emerging world and civilization, how that can be done with tangible views and forms. The article, James' contribution, upcoming, People Sharing Resources Toward a New Multilateralism of the Global Commons. It is the upcoming issues, just to be published here, coming soon. James, thanks again for joining us. This is a work in process, as I was saying. I look forward to continuing the conversation with you here.
John, great pleasure. Thank you very much.
And my my applause and thank you for the great work you've done. I think you've been a linchpin for this conversation, certainly for education, and brought forth these kinds of perspectives. Your experience, your acknowledgement of this, the higher view, getting up on the balcony, has been a perspective James has been doing for quite some time, and we have been delighted to have that balcony view here on Zoomed. That's where about big picture down to the up close and personal. And we will continue with the up close and personal in coming periods. But next week, we're building on this larger picture again. Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at Post Carbon Institute, will be joining us talking more about the current system. What is it about the flaws in the current system and the nature of peak oil and fossil fuels as we know it? What is a vision for possibility and future that we can have? Richard, join us next week. We'll be happy to continue that conversation. In the meantime, thanks again, James. Next time, enjoy. And this week, have a good week, all of you there out in Zoomed. And come back, spread the word. I think our conversation is a rich one. It's a dialectic that's bringing to bear multiple perspectives on this important transition, the new system of the world, breaking through where we are in the mud and how that might evolve with us all. Thanks again. John Schmidt here. Out until next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.